Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover, and thanks for coming out, and thanks for supporting your local and independent businesses, because it really does make a difference in our community. When I was thinking about this event, I was thinking about a card I've been carrying around for the last couple of years, which reads, falling down is a part of life, but getting back up is a part of living. And there's nothing more appropriate, and I think tonight's author and her story and her book marvelously captures that idea in the most bold and audacious way. After dealing with maybe the best of news and also the worst of news on the same day, the author came through so many things and actually found her way to our fair state here, and then began finding and found a great life with great many friends and great many people in this community. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce tonight's author, Nancy Sharp.
Hi, guys. I am so grateful that everybody came out tonight on this freezing cold night. I truly am. We worried a little bit that maybe the weather would keep people away, but I'm glad it hasn't, and I promise you I'm going to do everything I can to try to warm your spirits. I am so honored to be launching Both Sides Now at the Tattered Cover. It's almost hard for me to put it into words, and rarely am I speechless, but I truly feel a little bit speechless. I just feel very awed. It's a really momentous time for me to be releasing this book for a number of reasons, not just because it's my first book, but more so because it is actually the 10th anniversary this month that my husband Brett died. And that is a very, very big marker. To be honest, I'm not sure that I could have written this book any earlier than I did. I began to write Both Sides Now in earnest about 4 years ago. And when I first began to write the book, I started to write it in a very different way. Now, a lot of writers will tell you they just sort of, that first draft is so much about sort of, you know, getting it all out on paper. And that really was true in my case. But I also began to write it as a straight narrative. I began to write in traditional long chapters. I began to write it in a very linear fashion. And honestly, it was feeling kind of stifling. And I began to see that if it was feeling stifling for me as the writer, you know, and I began to feel that I needed sort of breathing space to reflect on my experience more, then surely my readers might feel that way too. So the gift of time and perspective not only helped me distill and process my own experience, but in terms of the writing process, it helped me to write the kind of book that I ended up writing. And by that, I mean, there's still people coming, thank you. By that, I mean that Both Sides Now, and for some of you who have read it, is written with a lot of white space. And it's written in short, fragmented chapters, and that's very intentional. It's intentional because that is the way of grief. It is very fragmented. There is nothing linear about the process. And certainly the rough edging on the paper was chosen very intentionally. It's my intention that this be a gift that people hold in their hands. There will be a digital version, of course, but it won't quite be the same. It's really important that this be a gift that you sort of hold in your hands and you think about and you reflect upon those times in your own lives when you've been confronted by adversity, because this really is a book about adversity. As Derek mentioned, and for those of you who know my story, Both Sides Now hinges on the very day that my twins, Rebecca and Casey, were born. That was May 20th, 2001. They came very, very early, as can happen with multiples. And it was unexpected. And it was even more expected when later that day, my husband, Brett, received a call from his neuro-oncologist at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, letting him know that his routine MRI, which had been absolutely clear for the past 18 months, came back with tumors showing in his brain and also down his spine. And it was just the most unbelievably surreal moment in time because, you know, here you are supposed to be celebrating life. And, you know, certainly even I knew before they told me that he was most certainly going to die. So that became one of the central questions that I wanted to explore in Both Sides Now, which is how is it that you hold life and death in the very same moment? You know, I think that so many of us deal with not only life and death issues, but deal with duality in life all the time. And we're uncomfortable with gray, right? I mean, think about it in your own lives. We like black and white. We want to feel one thing. We want to feel joy and only joy. We don't want to feel sadness at the same time. So these questions became very important for me to probe in the book. But obviously that there's more to my story in terms of what compelled me to write the book. And truthfully, the reason why I wrote Both Sides Now is because I really felt a responsibility to give back to other people who had also experienced loss. So many people would talk to me when Brett was ill, and you know, he was sick almost 7 years. It was a very, very long time. And, you know, I was writing articles and people would talk to me, and I began to feel as though my voice was reaching other people. And I felt when it was all over and when I had come to Colorado and when I had distilled and processed enough of my story that I really felt it was sort of the give back of loss. It was a responsibility I had to use my voice in a way to reach other people. Loss, of course, is very universal. I needn't tell you that. And it's defined in so many different ways. So I really think of it. I mean, for me, this story hinges on losing my husband. But we all have losses in our lives. And no matter where, what those losses are, we all have to find ways to move forward. And that's really what this book is about. I want to share with you some of the things that I learned from writing the book, because people ask me that a lot, and I think that's important for you to know. A lot of people wonder, well, was this cathartic? You know, this must have been a very cathartic, cleansing experience for you to write the book. And I would have to say, no, it was not cathartic at all. I think it was downright hellish at times, to be honest. It was really, 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 really hard. And it was much harder at certain moments than I ever could have anticipated. And there were a lot of times when I had to sort of shelve the book. Even though I wrote it in fragments, there were times I just had to put it away. But I think it was more for me about putting structure and order and integrating my story and my experience. And I think that's really important because it goes back to my original point about the gift of time and perspective. And I really did learn that I think it was only now that I could really make sense and integrate everything that happened to me and to put it together in a way that would make me feel more whole. And, you know, so there was so much trauma, early in my life, certainly when my children were first born. And even when we got to Colorado, it was so much just go, 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 do, do, do. So I think the ability to integrate and to give myself the time to do that was one of the most important things that I took from writing this book. I am going to read to you from the prologue because it sets the whole story up. So bear with me. I have to put my reading glasses on for this. Okay. So, November 2004. I sat among a small group of strangers at Rodef Shalom Synagogue on the Upper West Side. I wasn't praying. I was grieving. Everyone noticed that I was the youngest person by decades in this bereavement group. I was aware of them seeing me, a young woman wondering, why is she here? Sad as they appeared over their own losses, they looked at me with pity. No one asked my age, not at first. As my eyes searched the room, landing upon one gray-flecked head after another, I felt the oddity of being in this situation, young and old at the same time. I didn't want their pity. I didn't want anyone's pity. I only wanted to feel better. I listened to their stories, tales of long love, children, grandchildren, memories of museum outings, bike vacations, and retirement dreams cut short. The room was a sea of bereft voices. What was I doing here? I began to tap my heel on the carpet, thinking about the toast my son threw this morning while his twin sister banged the back of her head against the floor. They were 3.5 years old. We were working on potty training. I was fixed on these thoughts, restless to return home, when Ben, who sat across from me, snapped me out of it. A few times he opened his mouth to speak, then shut it, unable to find the words. He was in awful pain, crying with his eyes closed and gently pressing the tips of his long fingers together for comfort. His thin, white hair was askew. Ben was 97 years old, mourning his wife of more than 60 years. I was 38, mourning my husband, Brett, who had died a few months shy of his 40th birthday. Ben's griefs were tangled together like fishing line. He mourned his wife and his own end, which he expected soon. He still lived at home, alone. Every strained feature of his face suggested that he'd given up on living. What was the point? What kind of future could he really welcome? Some days I feared Ben might will himself to die in the room. If he did, at least he would be with people who understood. Did any of us really understand? I began to feel closer to Ben. Frail as he was, his spirit obviously needed healing. Why else would he be here? It was true that he mourned everything at once, and the question of mortality, which every surviving spouse, young and aged, contemplates, was real for Ben in a way it wasn't for me. Life can end at any point. There are no guarantees, but a man nearing 100 can have few illusions. This much was true. I would not have a future with my sweet husband. Those dreams had died. But probably I would have a future. Even though I couldn't see it then and was not yet able to grasp at anything concrete, wait a year, goes the common wisdom. Like Ben, I was thrown by all that had happened. But I couldn't exactly give up on life at 38. I wouldn't do that to myself, and I wouldn't do it to my young children. Ben shuffled his feet just like my grandfather. I felt protective of him, wanting to steady him with my arm since he used no cane. The trip here exhausted him, and each time he spoke, he cried. We became friends, and once I took him to a Shabbat service with my twins. It surprised me that being around him comforted me. His old age both separated us and drew me to him. Despite our differences, we felt a shared sense of brokenness. Besides, his name was my son's middle name, Ben, in memory of Brett's grandfather. One day, Ben brought all the women silver chains that his wife had made. He needed to share this offering, this relic of their lives. He knew, even in these fresh moments of grief, the chains would hold up against time. The one he gave me had rows of identical circles and was the length of half a belt. I wrapped it around my wrist and wore it as a bracelet. All these years later, it remains a favorite possession. I pictured Ben sitting on a floral couch next to his wife, a protective arm around her. She knew precisely where to lean her head, against his chest, the soft spot, hers alone. Ben gave me hope for a long life. It's the path I always saw for Brett and me, a long and certain life together. We married in our 20s, and because we had grown up in neighboring towns with parents still together and mutual friends of all ages, we shared an unspoken assumption about the way things would be, the forward path, the contained life. There will never be an acceptable answer to the question of why it happened. before Brett was diagnosed with this freakish pediatric brain tumor, running on the treadmill at the gym one day, falling against the walls in our apartment months later, I was one of those people who believed that things happen for a reason. Now I know the truth. This just isn't so. There was no rationale for why a healthy young man slipped behind the veil of life. It happened. But why everything at once? Newborn twins and a death sentence all on the same day. The question of why is like an underexposed negative. The image is so dark that the grayscale is hidden. I studied photography when Brett was very ill and my world lacked definition. What I discovered in the darkroom is that time and light are elemental to exposing the crisp details and sharp tones, to filling the frame and transcending it. Seeing takes time. We have to be patient to draw clarity from the fog. It is only now that I begin to understand the fluid line existing between past and present, remembrance and breathing, the scent of yesterday and the air of today. Brett has been gone 9 years, and still I see him in the light of day. It took all that time to reach this place of quiet dwelling, where the surety of the Rocky Mountains and a new husband and family meet my gaze each morning and steady me. A husband who lost a wife, boys who lost a mother, but who want badly in their own ways to feel a family again. Both sides now is my exploration of holding life and death in the same moment, when overnight you acquire the same life experience as a grandparent, but you are still young enough to have children in diapers and the chance for a different future. The question of why ultimately becomes, what next? Because in order to live and love again, you must determine where to place yourself in this altered world. In the words of Joni Mitchell, well, something's lost, but something's gained. But first, the story. Thank you. I have to take a sip of water, excuse me. So many sections I could have read, but that I felt like really sets the story up tonight. So where am I today? I am a true Coloradan, and I am thrilled to be a true Coloradan, I have to tell you. I love it here. I cannot imagine living anywhere else. It was bold living and faith that brought me here. We moved here June 17th, 2006, so you do the math. Math is not my forte. I'm a writer. I came and we came in search of a better life, and I feel so proud and so grateful to be standing here and to be able to reflect upon that life today. Bold living is also how I came to pick my amazing husband, Steve Saunders, straight from a magazine. You have to raise your hand. So a lot of you know the story, but a lot of you don't. And because it's Valentine's Day coming up, I'm going to just sort of synthesize it for you a little bit. So it's February 2007, and the twins and I have been here now about 6 months, and I'm reading the Rocky Mountain News, and Bill Husted, I have to give him credit, had in his column that 5280 was doing their best of singles issue, and this year the hot catch was Steve Saunders. And ladies, go get him. So, of course, I did not know who Steve was. I did not know who my esteemed father-in-law-to-be was, Dusty Saunders. I did not know who Patrick Saunders was or Brian Saunders. I didn't know really anything. But when I mentioned to friends that I'm thinking about reaching out to this guy, Steve Saunders, they said, well, of course, we know him. So I decided that I was going to send Steve an email and a photo. And, of course, I had learned by now that he, too, had been widowed, which is the only reason why I decided to write him, even though clearly he was very cute. That, you know, effort to reach out and to write Steve was very much an act of bold living, because honestly, I never in a million years thought anything would happen. I did it for me. It would have been crazy to have thought that anything would have happened, because it would have seemed like just too, I don't know, too calculated or something. The whole thing was so crazy. And yet it worked. So Steve and I have been married almost 6 years. It'll be 6 years this July, and we've blended our families. And it's not been easy. It's definitely been had its very challenging moments, but it has been really, really so rewarding, and I feel so fortunate. Steve is the only father my twins have ever known. And, you know, if ever there's a mensch, he really is one. can you not do that? Sorry, it's making me lose my focus. Sorry, it's making me lose my focus. That's okay. He is... Absolutely. I feel so lucky. And I'm so grateful that we have now a family of six and not just three. We've doubled all the goodness. And we've also doubled, speaking of duality, we've doubled some of the hard times too. Because with the present comes the past. And, you know, what Steve and I have learned in our relationship is that in order for our marriage to work, we have to make room for Brett and for Steve's first wife, Pam, and for the lives and children we created with them to simply be a part of who we are today, just not the whole part. Before I open this up to questions, I want to ask everybody if you would be kind enough to share news of the book with your friends, with your family, with anybody you feel might be touched by this story, anybody who has either had loss or maybe who feels stuck in his or her life and just needs to think about making some bold choices. I promise you, bold living really works. So I would love to answer any questions, and you can ask me anything you want, really. So thank you. Wow. One thing I should say also that I, when I give keynotes to groups, I give a keynote called The Art of Bold Living, and I talk in a little bit more detail about my recipe for bold living, and I'll spell it out for you here just, you know, in a nutshell, only because it might give you some things to ruminate on. So I literally break apart bold, B-O-L-D. B is for beauty. And beauty for me is both sides now. Beauty is that duality that we were talking about. It is pleasure and pain, stillness and sound, light and dark, life and death. Beauty is however you want to see it. And so oftentimes, beauty really is, you can see something beautiful in the hardest of moments. It's up to you. O is for opportunity. And I am a firm believer that you cannot wait for life to happen. You have to make life happen. L stands for liveliness. You need to be alive for today. Yet at the same time, it's okay to make the past a vivid part of the present. That is part of what contributes to being your most vivid self. And finally, D is for daring, because we should all dare to live the life we want to lead. So, now I'll open it up. Hi there.
Hi. My friend Libby lost her husband just before Christmas.
I'm sorry.
And had a baby just less than a month later, second son. And as her friend, I'm struggling with how to really support her. And so I just wonder what advice you would have. What did you need? What could her friends provide? You know, I've reached out a lot. I've sent a lot of cards. And I have said to her, as someone who's been through cancer myself and had to accept help from others, you have to ask for what you need. But I know that's hard for her to do. So what can we just provide that without her asking?
Probably right now the gift of patience, I would say, in time, because it's still pretty raw for her, I would imagine. And I'm sure she can't even think straight. I mean, not only has she just lost her husband, but she has a new baby. She's probably still got raging pregnancy hormones going on. And I don't know if she's got a point person, somebody who can help her. You know, you need a My Lifeline, honestly, to help her. So, and if anybody doesn't know about My Lifeline, I'm going to say this is Marcia Dunziger, who's a very special person. You should stand. I need to give you credit because she's amazing. She's my friend, And she is a cancer survivor, and she founded this incredible nonprofit organization called MyLifeline.org, which provides free websites for people with cancer and their families. And it makes it easier. It centralizes all the support and care. So I wonder if your friend has a point person who you could turn to. But I think concrete, specific things really help. People would ask me all the time, well, what can I do? I had no idea. I hope that helps. Anybody else? Hi, Patrick.
Hey, when you started writing the book, did you write it beginning, not as catharsis as you said, but to start it, or did you write it thinking you were going to get it published from the beginning?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, okay, truth be told, when Steve and I first got together, we had so many people come up to us and say, this is a book, this is a movie. And in fact, we were on our honeymoon, remember? And I don't know, some couple from Ireland and London, and they said, this is the best book, this is the best love story, and this, like, has to be a movie. So I guess that part of that was going on in our heads. And, you know, I had been writing about it for a variety of different magazines, but I hadn't put anything together just like this. So Steve and I actually first started to write this book together, and it was a bit of an experiment, I'll say. It wasn't so successful. Yes. I don't know. What do you think? Oh, if George Clooney's in the movie, I'm in that movie. Except I'm too tall for him. Anybody else? Hi, Natalie.
When did you decide to share at what stage the manuscript with your children?
Well, they haven't seen it yet. Good question. They are only 12. And I think that this is probably not a book for them just yet. There's a lot of things that they have yet to learn. And one of the things that has been very important to all of us in our process is respecting the readiness. You know, their readiness to absorb what they're ready to absorb, and also respecting the fact that certain things are hard for them. So, I mean, every year it changes, to be honest. I mean, I will say that earlier on, Casey, my son, was the one who I think internalized much more of this. And he seemed to be, for him, it was almost a visceral, primordial reaction, losing his dad. And there was a lot of active grief. And that's shifted over the years. And when we came to Colorado, our daughter, Rebecca, honestly has been the one who has been processing much more slowly, asking questions. You know, actually, I have a book of letters that friends and family wrote, some of you in this room, wrote for Casey and Rebecca to help them remember their father. And they haven't read those yet. They're too young. But actually, this brings up a good point, because about memory. And, you know, they lost their dad when they were 2.5 years old. They do not remember him at all. And that's a very different experience. It's not harder. It's not easier. It's just different. And I think in some ways he becomes an apparition for them. He becomes sort of larger than life. Would I have liked for them to have had memories, real memories? Yes, you bet. But they'll not have that. He lives on for them through our stories, through pictures, through videos. And that's what we do. And that's part of the... that's part of the bittersweet nature of being where I am today. Hi, Nance.
Hi. I've known you for a long time. I know your story and respected it, but I've always found the courage that you had to leave New York and come to Colorado, a place you had one friend, right? Your colleague.
She's here. You should stand up. She's in the book.
I just would love to know that decision-making process. I know she drew you here.
Well, not really. She thought I was crazy.
What was that like?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you so much for asking that. No, in all seriousness, she thought I was really a little crazy, and she was a little worried, right? I mean, you know, she was like, how are you going to do this? So the kids were just five at the time that we moved. But here's the backup. After Brett died, this was in 2004. February 2004. And, you know, you don't do anything right away. You sort of stay put. And that's what we did. But it felt really hard to be in New York City. It's not just because New York was so chaotic. I mean, it had once been wonderful. I loved that energy. But I began to feel that energy really, really drained me. Not to mention the fact that everywhere we went, there were ghosts. There were, you know, sort of shadows everywhere. And everything, the things that I had once loved and that had once sustained me, felt like they were really pulling me down. And, you know, I was turning 40. And there's nothing like a zero birthday to really make you reflect upon where you're at in your life. And the kids were going into kindergarten. And if you've ever tried to get one kid, let alone two, into a decent kindergarten in New York City, you know, good for you. But it was more than I could handle. And so it was kind of the confluence of all these things led me to realize that I needed to make a move. And I knew that I needed to make a very different kind of move. I just felt it in my gut, and I trusted it. And Colorado seemed a little safer than Italy. You know, I did sort of fantasize about really doing something wild, like going to Italy. But, you know, it's true that Julie was here, and her family, who had really been in some ways like second family to me since the time I was 18. But I also felt I could do it here. I wasn't going to sort of wind up on the street. You know, I could honestly, this was a more affordable lifestyle also. And it was the scenery that drew me here. I mean, my goodness. I mean, just to have this majesty stretched before you, to look out onto the world and to feel after what had happened to me that I could cast my gaze on something so expansive and something so sturdy and permanent, that sustained me. And that gave me the confidence, I think, also to feel like I could do it. And, you know, listen, if it didn't work out, I figured, well, you make a change. What's the worst that can happen? I don't think that anybody should ever feel like they're stuck in life. You know, my threshold for change, I've been told, is probably like off the charts. But I don't care. That's what I do. I don't do things indiscriminately. But, you know, I think that if something isn't working, you need to be daring enough to change it. Hi. Hi, Doug. Good.
Thank you for sharing. So, I've known you for a long time. You're as cute today as you've always been.
We went to college together, too.
I don't remember you always being this bold. Do you think it took the tragedy to
Yes and no. I think there was a part of me that, I'm thinking back, it's funny. This is sort of a crazy story, and I wouldn't recommend doing this on a job interview necessarily. Ryan, where are you, my stepson? The first time I ever really thought I was truly bold was I was in New York and I was working for Ketchum, but it was a big public relations firm, and I was eyeing this job at UNICEF, and it was a big position. It was like head of national media relations for the United States Committee for UNICEF. And I just decided I was going to give it everything I had. And, you know, I had some good experience, and I had done a project at the United Nations via Ketchum, so I had met people, and they were kind of interested in me, but there was a lot of competition even then. And I remember having a sort of the last interview with the senior vice president of UNICEF, and I said, if you hire me, I am going to be dynamite. And I think he was, like, so startled. And I really can't believe I said that. But I think when you really want something, you go after it with everything you have. At the same time, yeah, I think I felt emptied. You know, I felt like I had nothing left in me. It was almost 10 years, Doug, of caregiving and mourning and active grieving and then coming here. And, you know, I was ready to live a very different kind of a life. And I think that being in a new environment really helps you to transcend the past also. I think it's awfully difficult to stay put. I just actually talked to a friend the other day. My closest friend from college just died of a brain tumor, of all horrible, horrible coincidences, a few months ago. And I was talking to her husband the other day, and he said to me, they live in Boston. Now, this just happened, and they have a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old. And, you know, he said, I wish I could move. I don't know how I'm going to be able to do this here, but my kids are so rooted to their school. We're so rooted to this community. You know, it was different for me because my kids were just starting. Had they been further along, I'm honestly not sure that I could have done that. But you can still be bold in other ways. Every day. Every day. Hi, Vicki.
So, you blended your family, but both you and Steve have ghosts and shadows and people you really, really miss. So how has that worked out in your marriage, having these other people in the room?
Well, they're not always in their room, but they're part of the fabric of our lives. You know, they're part of the dinner time conversation, and we celebrate the milestones. Last year was the 10th anniversary that Pam died, and that was a very big marker. So she died a year before Brett. And, you know, we all celebrated is the wrong word, but we all got together and we acknowledged it. And I think it's really important to acknowledge those moments. Similarly, February 21st, it will be the 10th year, and I want to do something. And, you know, this is my family now, and we will all come together, because that is just life. It is just past and present at one. There's that sense of fluidity of time that I alluded to in the section that I read, and that, for me, is, you know, that has been so much a part of this process, and it helps ease those sorrows when you begin to think of the people you've lost as just kind of right here in this room. I mean, you know, we carry them with us all the time.
Have you had to, like, be sensitive to each other at
times? Yes. Yes. Yeah, we have, actually. So I think it's less so now. But certainly there are moments when, and I don't know all the key dates for him and his past life, and he doesn't know all the key events for me. And that's just, you know, but that's true of any second marriage, probably. So, but, you know, it's done with respect. Hi. I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
All right. What is your outlook on life and death now, given the circumstances of how everything happened? You being pregnant and finding out that your husband is going to eventually pass away. So, how do you view life and death now?
Right now, well, I definitely think of it as more of a, on a continuum. So we were talking before about that sense of fluidity, and it helps a lot to keep the memory of my husband alive, to talk about him. You know, I'm wearing tonight, you know, some jewelry of two of my grandmothers and also Julie's mother, who was incredibly dear to me, and they live with me. And so I find that we are so afraid to talk about death. It's so frightening for people. It's so concrete and so final. And I think that my view is that it doesn't need to be. I think that we can choose to honor the people that we have loved and lost, but I think that we need to come to some sort of gentle acceptance and peace with it. And that's really where I try to be, because, you know, it's inevitable. And we don't want to go there. Who wants to go there? But, I mean, loss is universal. And the people we love will die. And it's hard. It's hard to think in those terms. But you have to just try to capture every moment. And I think to sort of think along the broad spectrum of life and death as one. Somebody else had a hand up, I think. Hi, Luella.
Thank you.
That's a good question. Actually, my father-in-law passed away. Imagine that he died a year after Brett. So my mother-in-law lost her son and her husband within 2 years. It was unbelievable. And, you know, she was. But this brings up a good issue about the way people grieve. And it also brings up a really important component of dealing with illness, something called denial. And, you know, my mother-in-law really could not go there during the time that Brett was ill. She looked at everything through with rose-colored glasses because that was what she needed in order to survive this harrowing experience. You know, it frustrated me, honestly, at times, because I would feel, well, you know, we're hearing the same thing. Why are we coming away with, like, two different understandings? And in subsequent years, she's the same way. I actually said to her, you don't have to read the book. That's okay. I don't want you to read it. Because, you know what? Like, I actually feel I'm very protective of the people I love. And if I feel it's going to be hard for somebody, then I don't think they should read it. And I wouldn't be offended. And, you know, not in the least bit. And it was funny, her sister, my aunt, read it. And I think she felt, well, if her sister read it, then she had to read it. And it was hard for her to read it, truthfully. But she went there, and she goes there to the degree that she is willing. And I think it is extremely important to honor the path that people have, because everybody does it differently. And we just go where we need to go.
One more question? Or?
Kirsten. Yeah, yeah. I actually, great question. I have two that I'm considering right now. I've been working on a children's book that I'm going to reformat. And I'm going to just share this story really quickly because it's pertinent to this. And when you read the book, the inscription is the title of this book. It's called The Sky Is Everywhere. And it came from a moment in time when it was right after Brett died. The kids and I were in Connecticut, and, you know, they didn't go to the funeral. They were much too young. They had not been to a cemetery at that point either. And this grief psychologist I'd been taking them to, said, you know, why don't you just do a drive-by of a cemetery and just say, oh, there's a cemetery, and, you know, just see how they react. And, you know, that's also what I meant. You have to sort of see where kids are in the process. You don't want to throw anything down their throats. So we're in Easton, Connecticut, and there's this cemetery from, like, the 1600s. And I said, well, there's a cemetery. And so Rebecca said, is that where Daddy is? And before I had a chance to respond, Casey said, no, Rebecca, and Daddy's in the sky. And I was like, wow, where'd he get that one from? And he was always coming up with things like that, though. And very out-of-the-box child. That's another book. But not for me. So she said, well, is the sky back that way? Insinuating New York City, where we lived. And he said, no, Rebecca, the sky is everywhere. So that's one. And then the other is, I'm going to do something about bold living. So, and I don't know yet, but I'm working on it. And now you all have to buy books.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.